straight into the ancient, suspicious bastard node of his brain, leaving his higher brain centre free to freewheel. Fur and tights. What kind of wear was that for a watchman? Bashed in armour, greasy leather breeches and a tatty shirt with bloodstains on it. Someone else's for preference. That was the stuff. Nice feel of the cobbles through his boots. It was really comforting. Behind him, confusion running up and down the ranks, the procession slowed down to keep in step. Protector of the Kingi's peace, indeed. He'd said to the old man who delivered it, "What peace did you have in mind?" But that had fallen on stony ears. Damn silly thing anyway, he thought. A short length of wood with a lump of silver on the end. Even a constable got a decent sword. What was he supposed to do? Wave it at people? Ye gods, it was months since he'd had a good walk through the streets. Lot of people about today. Some parade on, wasn't there? Oh dear, said Captain Carrot in the crowd. What's he doing? Next to him, an Agatian tourist was industriously pulling the lever off his iconograph. Commander Vimes stopped and, with a faraway look in his eyes, tucked his truncheon under one arm and reached up to his helmet. The tourist looked up at Carrot and tugged his shirt politely.
Please, what is he doing now? He said.
He's taking out... Oh, no, said Angua. He's taking the ceremonial packet of cigars out of his helmet, said Carrot. And he's... Oh, he's lighting one. The tourist pulled the lever a few times.
Very historic tradition?
Memorable, murmured Angua. The crowd had fallen silent. No one wanted to break Vimes's concentration. There was the big, gusty silence of 1,000 people holding their breath.
What's he doing now? Said Carrot. Can't you see? Said Angua. Not with my hands over my eyes. Oh, the poor man. He's just blown a smoke ring.
First one of the day, he always does that. And now he's set off again, and now he's pulled out the truncheon and he's tossing it up in the air and catching it again. You know the way he does with his sword when he's thinking. He looks quite happy.
I think he's going to really treasure this moment of happiness, said Carrot.
Then the murmur started. The procession had halted behind Vimes. Some of the more impressionable people who weren't sure what they should be doing, and those who had partaken too heavily of the university's rather good sherry, started to fumble around on their person for something to throw up in the air and catch. After all, this was a traditional ceremony. If you took the view that you were not going to do things because they were apparently ridiculous, you might as well go home right now.
"He's tired, that's what it is," said Carrot. "He's been running around overseeing things for days. Night and day watches. You know what a hands-on person he is." "Let's hope the patrician will agree to let him stay that way. Oh, his lordship wouldn't... He wouldn't, would he?"
Laughter was starting. Vimes had started to toss the truncheon from one hand to the other. "He can make his sword spin 3 times and still catch it." Vimes' head turned. He looked up. His truncheon clattered onto the cobbles and rolled into a puddle unheeded. Then he started to run. Carrot stared at him and then tried to see what the man had been looking at.
"On top of the barbican," he said, "in that window. Isn't that someone up there? Excuse me.
He began to push his way through the crowd. Vimes was already a small figure in the distance, his red cloak flying out after him.
"Well, there's a lot of people watching the parade from high places," said Angua. "What's so special about..." "No one should be up there," said Carrot, starting to run, now he was free of the crowd. "It's all sealed up."
Angua looked around. Every face was turned towards the street theatre, and there was a cart nearby. She sighed and strolled behind it, wearing an expression of suspicious nonchalance. There was a gasp, a faint but distinctly organic sound, a muffled yelp, and then the clank of armour hitting the ground. Vimes didn't know why he ran. It was a sixth sense. It was when the back of the brain picked up out of the ether that something bad was going to happen and didn't have time to rationalize and just took over the spinal cord. No one could get to the top of the barbican. The barbican had been the fortified gateway in the days when Ankh-Morpork didn't regard an attacking army as a marvelous commercial opportunity. Some parts were still in use, but the bulk of it was 6 or 7 stories of ruin without stairs that any sensible man would trust. For years it had been used as an unofficial source of masonry for the rest of the city. Bits of it fell off on windy nights. Even gargoyles avoided it. He was aware that far behind him the noise of the crowd became a lot of shouting. 1 or 2 people screamed. He didn't turn round. Whatever was going on, Carrot could take care of it. Something overtook him. It looked like a wolf would look if one of its ancestors had been a long-haired Clachian hunting dog, one of those graceful things that were all nose and hair. It bounded ahead and through the crumbling gateway. The creature was nowhere to be seen when Vimes arrived, but the absence was not a matter that grabbed at his attention because of the more pressing presence of the corpse, lying in a mess of fallen masonry. One of the things Vimes had always said, that is to say, one of the things he said he always said, and no one disagrees with the commanding officer, was that sometimes small details, tiny little details, things that no one would notice in ordinary circumstances, grab your senses by the throat and scream, "See me!" There was a lingering, spicy scent in the air, and in the gap between a couple of cobblestones was a clove. It was 5 o'clock. Vimes and Carrot sat in the patrician's outer office, in silence except for the irregular ticking of the clock. After a while, Vimes said, "Let me have a look at that again." Carrot obediently pulled out the small square of paper. Vimes looked down at it. There was no mistaking what it showed. He tucked it into his own pocket.
Why do you want to keep it, sir?"
"Keep what?" said Vimes.
"The iconograph I borrowed from the tourist."
"I don't know what you're talking about," said Vimes.
"But you..."
"I can't see you going very far in the watch, Captain, if you go around seeing things that aren't there."
"Oh."
The clock seemed to tick louder.
"You're thinking something, aren't you, sir?"
"It is a use to which I occasionally put my brain, Captain, strange as it may seem."
"What are you thinking, sir?"
"What they want me to think," said Vimes.
"Who's they?"
"I don't know yet. One step at a time." A bell tinkled. Vimes stood up. "You know what I always say," he said. Carrot removed his helmet and polished it with his sleeve.
"Yes, sir. Everyone's guilty of something, especially the ones that aren't, sir."
"No, not that one."
Always take into consideration the fact that you might be dead wrong, sir."
"No, nor that one neither."
How come Nobby ever got a job as a watchman, sir? You say that a lot."
"No, I meant always act stupid, Carrot."
"Ah, right, sir. From now on I shall remember that you always said that, sir."
They put their helmets under their arms. Vimes knocked at the door.
"Come," said a voice.
The patrician was standing at the window. Sitting or standing around the office were Lord Rust and the others. Vimes never quite understood how the civic leaders were chosen. They just seemed to turn up, like a tack on the sole of your shoe.
"Ah, Vimes," said Vetinari. "Sir, let us not beat about the bush, Vimes. How did the man get up there when your people had so thoroughly checked everything last night?"
"Magic?"
"Couldn't say, sir."
Carrot, still staring straight ahead, blinked.
"Your people did check the barbican, I assume?"
"No, sir."
"They didn't?"
"No, sir. I did that myself."
"You physically checked it yourself, Vimes," said Boggis of the Thieves Guild.
Captain Carrot could feel Vimes's thoughts at this point.
"That is correct, Boggis," said Vimes, without turning his head. "But we think someone got in where the windows are boarded up and pulled the boards back after him. Dust has been disturbed, and you didn't spot this, Vimes?"
Vimes sighed. "It'd be hard enough to spot the nailed-back boards in daylight, Boggis, let alone in the middle of the night."
"Not that we did," he added to himself. "Angua smelled the scent on them."
Lord Vetinari sat down at his desk.
"The situation is grave, Vimes."
"Yes, sir."
"His Highness is very seriously injured, and Prince Cadram, we understand, is beside himself with rage.
They insist on keeping his brother in the embassy," said Lord Rust. "A studied insult, as if we haven't good surgeons in this city."
"That's right, of course," said Vimes, "and many of them could give him a decent shave and a haircut, too."
"Are you making fun of me, Vimes?"
"Certainly not, my lord," said Vimes. "In my opinion, no surgeons anywhere have cleaner sawdust on their floors than the ones in this city." Rust glared at him. The patrician coughed.
"You have identified the assassin?" said the patrician.
Carrot was expecting Vimes to say, alleged assassin, sir, but instead he said, yes, he is, he was, called Ossie Brant, sir. No other name that we know. Lived in Market Street, did odd jobs from time to time, bit of a loner. No relatives or friends that we can find. We are making inquiries.
And that's all you fellows know, said Lord Downey.
It took some time to identify him, sir, said Vimes stolidly.
Oh, why should that be?
Couldn't give you the technical answer, sir, but it looked to me like they wouldn't need to make him a coffin. They could just have posted him between two barn doors.
Was he acting alone?
We only found the one body, sir, and a lot of recently fallen masonry, so it looks... I meant, does he belong to any organisation? Any suggestion that he's anti-Clatchian?
Apart from him trying to kill one?
Inquiries are continuing.
Are you taking this seriously, Vimes?
I have put my best men on the job, sir. Who's looking worried? Sergeant Colon and Corporal Nobbs. Who's looking relieved? Very experienced men, the keystones of the watch.
Colon and Nobbs, said the patrician.
Really?
Yes, sir. Their gazes met very briefly.
We're getting some very threatening noises, Vimes, said Vetinari.
What can I say, sir? I saw someone up on the tower, I ran. Someone shot the prince with an arrow, and then I found the man at the bottom of the tower very obviously dead with a broken bow and a lot of rock beside him. The storm last night probably loosened things up. I can't make up facts that don't exist, sir.
Carrot watched the faces round the table. The general expression was one of relief.
A lone bowman, said Vetinari, an idiot with some kind of mad grudge, who died in the execution of the, attempted execution. And, of course, valiant action by our watchman probably at least prevented an immediately fatal shot.
Valiant action, said Downey. I knew Captain Carrot here ran towards the VIPs, and Vimes headed for the tower, but frankly, Vimes, your strange behaviour beforehand...
Somewhat immaterial now, said Lord Vetinari.
Once again he adopted a slightly faraway voice, as if reporting to somebody else.
If Commander Vimes had not slowed down the procession, the wretch would undoubtedly have got a much better shot. As it was, the man panicked. Yes, the prince possibly would accept that.
Prince? Said Vimes.
But the poor devil... His brother, said the patrician.
Oh, the nice one.
Thank you, Commander, said the patrician. Thank you. Gentlemen, do not let me detain you. Oh, Vimes, just a brief word, if you would be so good. Not you, Captain Carrot.
I'm sure someone is committing some crime somewhere. Vimes remained staring at the far wall while the room emptied. Vetinari left his chair and went over to the window.
Strange days indeed, Commander, he said.
Sir.
For example, I gather that this afternoon Captain Carrot was on the roof of the Opera House firing arrows down towards the archery butts.
Very keen lad, sir.
It could well be that the distance between the Opera House and the targets is about the same, you know, as the distance between the top of the barbican and the spot where the prince was hit.
Just fancy that, sir.
Vetinari sighed.
And why was he doing this?
It's a funny thing, sir, but he was telling me just the other day that in fact it is still law that every citizen should do 1 hour's archery practice every day. Apparently the law was made in 1356, and it's never been...
Do you know why I sent Captain Carrot away just now, Vimes?
Couldn't say, sir.
Captain Carrot is an honest young man, Vimes.
Yes, sir.
And did you know that he winces when he hears you tell a direct lie?
Really, sir?
Damn. I can't stand to see his poor face twitch all the time, Vimes.
Very thoughtful of you, sir.
Where was the second bowman, Vimes?
Damn.
Second bowman, sir? Have you ever had a hankering to go on the stage, Vimes?
Yes, at the moment I'd leap on it wherever it's heading, thought Vimes.
No, sir.
Pity. I am certain you're a great loss to the acting profession. I believe you said that the man had put the boards back after him.
Yes, sir.
Nailed them back?
Blast.
Yes, sir. From the outside?
Damn.
Yes, sir. A particularly resourceful lone bowman, then.
Vimes didn't bother to comment. Vetinari sat down at his desk, raised his steepled fingers to his lips, and stared at Vimes over the top of them.
Colon and Nobbs are investigating this?
Really?
Yes, sir. If I were to ask you why, you'd pretend not to understand?
Vimes let his forehead wrinkle in honest perplexity.
Sir? If you say sir again in that stupid voice, Vimes, I swear there will be trouble.
They're good men, sir.
However, some people might consider them to be unimaginative, stolid, and, how can I put this, possessed of an inbuilt disposition to accept the first explanation that presents itself and then bunk off somewhere for a quiet smoke? A certain lack of imagination? An ability to get out of their depth on a wet pavement? A tendency to rush to judgment?
I hope you're not impugning my men, sir.
Vimes, Sergeant Coulon and Corporal Nobbs have never been puned in their entire lives.
Sir?
And yet, in fact, we do not need complications, Vimes. An ingenious lone madman.
Well, there are many madmen.
A regrettable incident.
Yes, sir.
The man was looking harassed, and Vimes felt there was room for a pinch of sympathy.
Fred and Nobby don't like complications either, sir.
We need simple answers, Vimes.
Sir, Fred and Nobby are good at simple.
The patrician turned away and looked out over the city.
Ah, he said in a quieter voice, simple men to see the simple truth. This is a fact, sir.
You are learning fast, Vimes.
Couldn't say about that, sir.
And when they have found the simple truth, Vimes?
Can't argue with the truth, sir.
In my experience, Vimes, you can argue with anything.
When Vimes had gone, Lord Vetinari sat at his desk for a while, staring at nothing. Then he took a key from a drawer and walked across to a wall where he pressed a particular area. There was a rattle of a counterweight. The wall swung back. The patrician walked softly through the narrow passageway beyond. Here and there it was illuminated by a very faint glow from around the edges of the little panels, which, if gently slid back, would allow someone to look out through the eye sockets of a handy portrait. They were a relic of a previous ruler. Vetinari never bothered with them. Looking out of someone else's eyes wasn't the trick. There was a certain amount of travel up dark stairways and along musty corridors. Occasionally he'd make movements the meaning of which might not be readily apparent. He'd touch a wall here and here, apparently without thinking, as he passed. Along one stone-flagged passage, lit only by the grey light from a window forgotten by everyone except the most optimistic flies, he appeared to play a game of hopscotch, robes flying around him and calves twinkling as he skipped from stone to stone. These various activities did not seem to cause anything to happen. Eventually, he reached a door which he unlocked. He did this with some caution. The air beyond was full of acrid smoke, and the steady pop-pop sound which he had begun to hear further back along the passage was now quite loud. It faltered for a moment, was followed by a much louder bang, and then a piece of hot metal whirled past the patrician's ear and buried itself in the wall. In the smoke, a voice said,
"Oh, dear."
It didn't seem unhappy, but sounded rather like the voice one might use to a sweet and ingratiating little puppy, which, despite one's best efforts, is sitting next to a spreading damp patch on the carpet. As the billows cleared, the indistinct shape of the speaker turned to Vetinari with a wan little smile and said,
"Fully 15 seconds this time, my lord. There is no doubt that the principle is sound."
That was one of Leonard of Quirm's traits. He picked up conversations out of the air, he assumed everyone was an interested friend, and he took it for granted that you were as intelligent as he was.
Bettinari peered at a small heap of bent and twisted metal.
"What was it, Leonard?" he said.
"An experimental device for turning chemical energy into rotary motion," said Leonard. "The problem, you see, is getting the little pellets of black powder into the combustion chamber at exactly the right speed, and one at a time. If two ignite together, well, what we have is the external combustion engine."
"And what would be the purpose of it?" said the patrician.
"I believe it could replace the horse," said Leonard proudly.
They looked at the stricken thing. "One of the advantages of horses that people often point out," said Vetinari after some thought, "is that they very seldom explode. Almost never, in my experience, apart from that unfortunate occurrence in the hot summer a few years ago." With fastidious fingers, he pulled something out of the mess. It was a pair of cubes, made out of some soft white fur, and linked together by a piece of string. There were dots on them.
"Dice," he said.
Leonard smiled in an embarrassed fashion.
"Yes, I can't think why I thought they'd help it go better. It was just, well, an idea. You know how it is?"
Lord Vetinari nodded. He knew how it was. He knew how it was far more than Leonard of Querm did, which was why there was one key to the door, and he had it. Not that the man was a prisoner, except by dull humdrum standards. He appeared rather grateful to be confined in this light, airy attic with as much wood, paper, sticks of charcoal and paint as he desired, and no rent or food bills to pay. In any case, you couldn't really imprison someone like Leonard of Querm. The most you could do was lock up his body. The gods alone knew where his mind went. And although he had so much cleverness it leaked continually, he couldn't tell you which way the political wind was blowing, even if you fitted him with sails. Leonard's incredible brain sizzled away alarmingly, an overloaded chip pan on the stove of life. It was impossible to know what he would think of next, because he was constantly reprogrammed by the whole universe. The sight of a waterfall or a soaring bird would send him spinning down some new path of practical speculation that invariably ended in a heap of wire and springs and a cry of, "I think I know what I did wrong!" He'd been a member of most of the craft guilds in the city, but had been thrown out for getting impossibly high marks in the exams, or in some cases, correcting the questions. It was said that he'd accidentally blown up the alchemist's guild, using nothing more than a glass of water, a spoonful of acid, two lengths of wire, and a ping-pong ball. Any sensible ruler would have killed off Leonard, and Lord Vetinari was extremely sensible, and often wondered why he had not done so. He decided that it was because, imprisoned in the priceless inquiring amber of Leonard's massive mind, underneath all that bright investigative genius, was a kind of willful innocence that might in lesser men be called stupidity. It was the seat and soul of that force which down the millennia had caused mankind to stick its fingers in the electric light socket of the universe and play with the switch to see what happened, and then be very surprised when it did. It was, in short, something useful. And if the patrician was anything, he was the political equivalent of the old lady who saves bits of string because you never know when they might come in handy. After all, you couldn't plan for every eventuality, because that would involve knowing what was going to happen. And if you knew what was going to happen, you could probably see to it that it didn't, or at least happened to someone else. So the patrician never planned. Plans often got in the way. And finally, he kept Leonard around because the man was easy to talk to. He never understood what Lord Vetinari was talking about. He had a world view about as complex as that of a concussed duckling, and above all, never really paid attention. This made him an excellent confidant. After all, when you seek advice from someone, it's certainly not because you want them to give it. You just want them to be there while you talk to yourself.
"I've just made some tea," said Leonard. "Will you join me?"
He followed the patrician's gaze to a brown stain all up one wall, which ended in a star of molten metal in the plaster.
"I'm afraid the automatical tea engine went wrong," he said. "I shall have to make it by hand."
"So kind," said Lord Vetinari. He sat down amidst the easels, and while Leonard busied himself at the fireplace, leafed through the latest sketches. Leonard sketched as automatically as other people scratched. Genius, a certain kind of genius, fell off him like dandruff. There was a picture of a man drawing, the lines catching the figure so accurately it appeared to stand out of the paper. And around it, because Leonard never wasted white space, were other sketches, scattered aimlessly. A thumb, a bowl of flowers, a device apparently for sharpening pencils by water power. Vetinari found what he was looking for in the bottom left-hand corner, sandwiched between a sketch for a new type of screw and a tool for opening oysters. It, or something very much like it, was always there, somewhere. One of the things that made Leonard such a rare prize, and kept him under such secure lock and key, was that he really didn't see any difference between the thumb and the roses and the pencil sharpener, and this.
"Ah, the self-portrait," said Leonard, returning with two cups.
"Yes, indeed," said Vetinari. "But my eye was drawn to this little sketch here. The war machine."
"Oh, that, mere nothing. Have you ever noticed the way in which the dew on roses..."
"This bit here, what is it for?" said Vetinari, pointing persistently.
"Oh, that's just the throwing arm for the balls of molten sulphur," said Leonard, picking up a plate of small cakes. "I calculate that one should get a range of almost half a mile, if one detaches the endless belt from the driving wheels and uses the oxen to wind the windlass."
"Really?" said Vetinari, taking in the carefully numbered parts. "And it could be built?"
"What? Oh, yes. Macaroon, in theory."
"In theory?"
"No one would ever actually do it, raining unquenchable fire down upon fellow humans. Ho, ho, ho."
Leonard sprayed macaroon crumbs.
"You'd never find an artisan to build it, or a soldier who would pull the lever. That's part 3B on the plan, just here, look."
"Ah, yes," said Vetinari. "Anyway," he added, "I imagine these huge power arms here couldn't possibly be operated without them breaking."
"Seize and dash and you, laminated and held together by special steel bolts," said Leonard promptly. "I made a few calculations just there below the sketch of light on a raindrop, as an intellectual exercise, obviously."
Vetinari ran his eye along several lines of Leonard's spidery mirror writing.
"Oh, yes," he said glumly. He put the paper aside. "Have I told you that the Clatchian situation is intensely political? Prince Kadram is trying to do a great deal very fast. He needs to consolidate his position. He is depending on support that is somewhat volatile. There are many plotting against him, I understand."
"Really? Well, this is the sort of thing people do," said Leonard. "Incidentally, I've recently been examining cobwebs, and I know this will interest you. Their strength in relation to their weight is much greater even than our best steel wire. Isn't that fascinating?"
"What kind of weapon do you intend to make out of them?" said the patrician.
"Sorry?"
"Oh, nothing. I was just thinking aloud."
"And you haven't touched your tea," said Leonard.
Vetinari looked around the room. It was full of things. Tubes and odd paper kites, and things that looked like the skeletons of ancient beasts. One of Leonard's saving graces, in a very real sense, from Vetinari's point of view, was his strange attention span. It wasn't that he soon got bored with things. He didn't seem to get bored with anything. But since he was interested in everything in the universe all the time, the end result tended to be that an experimental device for disemboweling people at a distance then became a string-weaving machine and ended up as an instrument for ascertaining the specific gravity of cheese. He was as easily distracted as a kitten. All that business with the flying machine, for example, giant bat wings hung from the ceiling even now. The patrician had been more than happy to let him waste his time on that idea, because it was obvious to anyone that no human being would ever be able to flap the wings hard enough. He needn't have worried. Leonard was his own distraction. He had ended up spending ages designing a special tray so that people could eat their meals in the air. A truly innocent man. And yet always, always some little part of him would sketch these wretchedly beguiling engines, with their clouds of smoke and carefully numbered engineering diagrams.
"What's this?"
Bettinari said, pointing to yet another doodle. It showed a man holding a large metal sphere.
That, oh, something of a toy, really, makes use of the strange properties of some otherwise quite useless metals. They don't like being squeezed, so they go bang, with extreme alacrity.
Another weapon?
Certainly not, my lord. It would be no possible use as a weapon. I did think it might have a place in the mining industries, though.
Really?
For when they need to move mountains out of the way?
Tell me, Vetinari said, putting this paper aside as well, you don't have any relatives in Klatch, do you?
I don't believe so. My family lived in Quirm for generations.
Oh, good. But, very clever people in Klatch, are they?
Oh, in many disciplines they practically wrote the scroll. Fine metalwork, for example.
Metalwork, the patrician sighed.
And alchemy, of course. Afia Alchema's Principia Explosia has been the seminal work for more than 100 years.
Alchemy, said the patrician glumly. Sulphur and so forth.
Yes, indeed.
But the way you put it, these major achievements were some considerable time ago. Lord Bettinari sounded like a man straining to see a light at the end of the tunnel.
Certainly, I would be astonished if they haven't made considerable progress, said Leonard of Quirm happily.
Ah. The patrician sank a little in his chair. It had turned out that the end of the tunnel was on fire.
A splendid people with much to recommend them, said Leonard. I always thought it was the presence of the desert. It leads to an urgency of thought. It makes you aware of the briefness of life.
The patrician glanced at another page. Between a sketch of a bird's wing and a careful drawing of a ball joint was a little doodle of something with spiked wheels and spinning blades. And then there was the device for moving mountains aside. The desert is not required, he said. He sighed again and pushed the pages aside. Have you heard about the lost continent of Leshp? He said.
Oh, yes. I did some sketches there a few years ago, said Leonard. Some interesting aspects, I recall. More tea? I fear you've let that one get cold. Was there anything you particularly wanted?
The patrician pinched the bridge of his nose.
I'm not sure. There is a small problem developing. I thought perhaps you could help.
Unfortunately, the patrician glanced at the sketches again. I suspect that you can. He stood up, straightened his robe, and forced a smile.
You have everything that you require? Some more wire would be nice, said Leonard, and I have run out of burnt umber.
I shall have some sent along directly, said Vetinari. And now, if you will excuse me. He let himself out. Leonard nodded happily as he cleared away the teacups. The infernal combustion engine was carried to the heap of scrap metal beside the small forge, and he fetched a ladder and removed the piston from the ceiling. He'd just opened out his easel to start working on a new design when he was aware of a distant pattering. It sounded like someone running, but also occasionally pausing to hop sideways on one leg. Then there was a pause, such as might be made by someone adjusting their clothing and getting their breath back. The door opened, and the patrician returned. He sat down and looked carefully at Leonard of Quirm.
"You did what?"
he said. Vimes turned the clove over and over under the magnifying glass.
"I see tooth marks," he said.
"Yes, sir,"
said Littlebottom, who represented in her entirety the watch's forensic department.
"Looks like someone was chewing it like a toothpick."
Vimes sat back.
"I would say," he said, "that this was last touched by a swarthy man of about my height. He had several gold teeth and a beard, and a slight cast in one eye, scarred. He was carrying a large weapon, curved, I'd say, and you'd have to call what he was wearing a turban because it wasn't moving fast enough to be a badger."
Littlebottom looked astonished.
"Detectoring is like gambling," said Vimes, putting down the clove. "The secret is to know the winner in advance. Thank you, Corporal. Write down that description and make sure everyone gets a copy, please. He goes by the name of 71-Hour Ahmed. Heaven knows why. And then go and get some rest.
Vimes turned to face Carrot and Angua, who had crammed into the tiny little room, and nodded at the girl.
I followed the clove smell all the way down to the docks, she said.
And then?
Then I lost it.
Angua looked embarrassed. I didn't have any trouble through the fish market, sir, or in the slaughterhouse district. And then it went into the spice market.
Ah, I see. And didn't come out again?
In a way, sir. Or came out going 50 different ways. Sorry.
Can't be helped. Carrot?
I did what you said, sir. The top of the opera house is about the right distance from our archery butts. I used a bow just like the one he used, sir.
Vimes raised a finger.
Carrot stared and then slowly said, like the one you found next to him.
Right. And?
It's a burly and strong in the arm sure shot five, sir. A bow for the expert. I'm not a great bowman, but I could at least hit the target at that elevation, but...
I'm ahead of you, said Vimes. You're a big lad, Carrot. Our late Ossie had arms like Nobby. I could put my hand round them.
Yes, sir. It's a 100-pound draw. I doubt if he could even pull the string back.
I'd hate to watch him try. Good grief, the only thing he could be sure of hitting with a bow like that would be his foot. By the way, do you think anyone saw you up there?
I doubt it, sir. I was right in among the chimneys and the air vents.
Vimes sighed.
Captain, I expect if you'd done it in a cellar at midnight, his lordship would have said, wasn't it rather dark down there, next morning?
He took out the by now rather creased picture. There was Carrot, or at least Carrot's arm and ear, as he ran towards the procession. And there, among the people in the procession, turning to look at him, was the face of the prince. There was no sign of 71-Hour Ahmed. He'd been at the soiree, hadn't he? But then there'd been all that milling around at the door, people changing places, treading on one another's robes, nipping back to the privy, walking into one another. He could have gone anywhere.
And the prince fell as you got to him, with the arrow in his back. He was still facing you.
Yes, sir, I'm sure of that. Everyone else was milling around, of course.
So he was shot in the back by a man in front of him who could not possibly have used the bow that he didn't shoot him with from the wrong direction.
There was a tapping at the window.
That'll be down, Spout, said Vimes without looking round. I sent him on an errand.
Downspout never quite fitted in. It wasn't that he didn't get on with people, because he hardly ever met people, except those whose activities took them above, say, second-floor level. Constable Downspout's beat was the rooftops. Very slowly. He'd come down for the watch's hog's watch party, and had poured gravy into his ears to show willing, but gargoyles got very nervy indoors at ground level, and he had soon exited via the chimney, and his paper squeaker had echoed out forlornly amongst the snowy rooftops all night. But gargoyles were good at watching, and good at remembering, and very, very good at being patient.
Vimes opened the window.
Moving jerkily, Downspout unfolded himself into the room, and then quickly scrambled up onto a corner of Vimes's desk for the comfort that it brought. Angua and Carrot stared at the arrow the gargoyle held in his hand.
"Ah, well done," said Vimes in the same even voice. "Where did you find it, Downspout?"
Downspout spluttered a series of guttural syllables only pronounceable by someone with a mouth shaped like a pipe.
"In the wall on the second floor of the dress shop in the Plaza of Broken Moons,"
Carrot translated.
"Ish,"
said Downspout.
"That's barely halfway to Sartor Square, sir."
"Yes," said Vimes. "A small, weak man trying to pull a heavy bow. The arrow wobbling all over the place. Thank you very much, Downspout. There will be an extra pigeon for you this week."
said Downspout and clambered back out of the window.
"Excuse me, sir," said Angua.
She took the arrow from Vimes and, closing her eyes, sniffed at it gingerly.
"Oh, yes, Ossie," she said, "all over it."
"Thank you, Corporal. It's as well to be sure."
Carrot took the arrow from the werewolf and looked at it critically.
"Huh, peacock feathers and a plated point. It's the sort of thing an amateur buys because he thinks it'll magically improve his shot. Showy."
"Right," said Vimes. "You, Carrot, and you, Angua, you're on the case."
"Sir, I don't understand," said Carrot. "I am perplexed. I thought you said Fred and Nobby were investigating this."
"Yes," said Vimes. "But Sergeant Colon and Corporal Nobbs are investigating why the late Ossie tried to kill the prince. And you know what? They're going to find lots of clues. I just know it."
I can feel it in my water.
But we know he couldn't have, said Carrot.
Isn't this fun? Said Vimes. I don't want you to get in Fred's way. Just, ask around. Try Dunnett Duncan or Sidney Lopsides. Heh, there's a man with his ear to the ground, all right. Or the Agony Aunts, or Lily Goodtime. Or Mr. Slider. Haven't seen him around for a while, but...
He's dead, sir.
What? Smelly Slider? When?
Last month, sir. He got hit by a falling bedstead. Freak accident, sir.
No one told me.
You were busy, sir. But you put some money in the envelope when Fred brought it round, sir. $10, which Fred remarked was very generous.
Vimes sighed. Oh, yes, the envelopes. Fred was always wandering around with an envelope these days. Someone was always leaving, or some friend of the watch was in trouble, or there was a raffle, or the tea money was low again, or some complicated explanation, so Vimes just put some money in. Simplest way. Old Smelly Slider.
You should have mentioned it, he said reproachfully.
You've been working hard, sir.
Any other street news you haven't mentioned, Captain?
Not that I can think of, sir.
All right. Well, see which way the wind is blowing, very carefully, and trust no one. Carrot looked worried.
I can trust Angua, can't I? He said.
Well, of course you... And you, presumably.
Me?
Well, obviously, that goes without say.
Corporal Littlebottom, she can be very helpful.
Cheery, yes, certainly you can trust you.
Sergeant Detritus, I always thought he was very
Detritus, oh yes, he...
Nobby, should I...
Carrot, I understand what he means, said Angua, tugging his arm.
Carrot looked a little crestfallen.
I've never liked, you know, underhand things, he mumbled.
I don't want any written reports, said Vimes, grateful for that small mercy. This is unofficial, but officially unofficial, if you see what I mean.
Angua nodded. Carrot just stayed looking dismal.
She's a werewolf, thought Vimes. Of course she understands. And you'd think a man who is technically a dwarf would be able to fold his head around the idea of subterfuge.
Look, just listen to the streets, said Vimes. The streets know everything. Talk to Blind Hugh.
I'm afraid he passed away last month, said Carrot.
Did he? No one told me.
I thought I sent you a memo, sir.
Vimes glanced guiltily at his overloaded desk and then shrugged.
Have a quiet look at things, get to the bottom of things, and trust practically no one, all right, except trustworthy people.
Come on, open up, watch business.
Corporal Nobbs pulled at Sergeant Colan's sleeve and whispered in his ear.
Not watch business, said Colan, pounding the door again. Nothing to do with the watch at all. We're all just, civilians, all right?
The door opened a crack.
Yes, said a voice that counted its small change. We have to ask some questions, missus.
Are you the watch? Said the voice.
No, I think I just made that clear.
Piss off, copper.
The door slammed.
You sure this is the right place, Sarge? Harry Chestnut said he saw Ossie going in here. Come on, open up.
Everyone's looking at us, Sarge, said Nobby.
Doors and windows had opened all along the street.
And don't call me Sarge when we're in plain clothes.
Right you are, Fred. That's...
Colan hesitated in an agony of status.
Well, that's Frederick to you, Nobby.
And they're giggling, Fred. Ick, Frederick.
We don't want to make a cock-up of this, Nobby.
Right, Frederick. And that's Cecil, thank you.
Cecil?
That is my name, said Nobby coldly.
Have it your way, said Colan. Just remember who's the superior civilian around here, all right?
He hammered on the door again.
We hear you've got a room to let, missus, he yelled.
Brilliant, Frederick, said Nobby. That was bloody brilliant.
Well, I am the sergeant, right?
Colan whispered.
No. Yeah, right. Well, you just remember that, right?
The door snapped open. The woman within had one of those faces that had settled over the years, as though it had been made of butter and then left in the sun. But age hadn't been able to do much with her hair. It was a violent ginger and piled up like a threatening thunderhead.
"Room? You should have said," she said.
$2 a week, no pets, no cooking, no women after 6 a.m. If you don't want it, thousands do. Are you with the circus? You look like you're with the circus.
Plain clothes was the problem. Both the men had been used to uniforms all their lives. Sergeant Colan's only suit had been bought by a man 2 stone lighter and 10 years younger, so the buttons creaked under tension. And Nobby's idea of plain clothes was the ribbon and bell-bedecked costume he wore as a leading member of the Ankh-Morpork Folk Dance and Song Society. Small children had followed them in the street to see where the show was going to be.
"We're..."
Colan began, and then stopped. There were undoubtedly a large number of things to be apart from policemen, but there and then, he couldn't think of any of them.
Actors, said Nobby.
Then it's payment a week in advance, said the woman, and no filthy foreign habits. This is a respectable house, she added, in defiance of evidence so far.
We ought to see the room first, said Colan.
Oh, the choosy sort, eh?
She led them upstairs. The room vacated so terminally by Ossie was small and bare. A few items of clothing hung on nails in the wall, and a heap of wrappers and greasy bags indicated that Ossie had been a man who ate, as it were, off the street.
"Whose is this stuff?" said Sergeant Colan. "Oh, he's gone now. I told him he'd be out if he didn't pay up. I'll throw it all out afore you settle in."
"We'll get rid of it for you,"
said Sergeant Colan. He fumbled in his pouch and produced a couple of dollars.
"Here you are, Mrs. Spent,"
said Mrs. Spent. She gave them a lopsided look.
"Are you both stopping here, or what?"
"Nah, I've just come along as his chaperone," said Colan, giving her a friendly grin. "He has to fight women off when they find out about his sexual magnetism."
Mrs. Spent gave the shocked Nobby a sharp look and bustled out of the room.
"What you going to say that for?"
said Nobby.
"It's got rid of her, hasn't it? You were having a go at me, don't deny it, just because I'm going through a bit of emotional what's-name, eh?
It was just a joke, Nobby, just a joke."
Nobby peered under the narrow bed.
"Wow,"
he said, all emotional what's-names forgotten.
"What is it? What is it?"
said Colan.
"It looks like a complete run of bows and ammo, and..."
Nobby pulled another stack of badly engraved magazines out into the light.
"Here's Warrior of Fortune, look, and practical siege weapons."
Colan leafed through page after page of very similar-looking people holding very similar weapons of personal destruction.
"You gotta be a bit odd to sit around all day reading this kind of thing," he said.
"Yeah," said Nobby. "Here, don't put that one back, that's last August's issue. I ain't got that one. Hang on, there's a box right at the back."
He wriggled out, towing a small box with him. It was locked, but the cheap metal gave away when he accidentally levered at the lid. Silver coins gleamed. Lots and lots of them.
"Whoops," he muttered. "We're in trouble now."
"That's Clatchian money, that is," said Colan. "Sometimes people slip you one instead of half a dollar in your change. Look, there's all curly writing on them."
"We're in big trouble," said Nobby.
"No, no, no. This is a clue, what we have found by patient detectoring," said Sergeant Colan. "And it's going to be a feather in our caps, and no mistake, when Mr. Vimes hears about it."
"How much do you reckon there is?"
"Got to be hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth," said Colan. "And that's a lot of money to a Clatchian. You can probably live like a king for a year and a dollar in Clatch."
"It wasn't very patient detectoring," said Nobby doubtfully. "All I did was look under the bed."
"Ah, but that's because you is trained," said Colan. "Your basic civilian wouldn't think of that right." "Ha, ha, ha, it all begins to make sense."
"Does it?
Why would the Clatchians give him money to shoot a Clatchian?" said Nobby. Colan tapped the side of his nose.
"Politics," he said.
"Oh, politics," said Nobby.
"Oh, well, politics, I see. Yeah, politics, right. So, why?"
"Aha,"
said Colan again, tapping the other side of his nose.
"Why are you picking your nose, Sarge?"
"I'm tapping it," said Colan severely. "That's to show I'm in the know."
"In the nose," said Nobby cheerfully.
"It's just the sort of underhand cunning thing they do," said Colan.
paying us to kill them, said Nobby.
Ah, you see, some Clatchian knob gets topped here, and then they can send a snotty note saying, you killed our big knob, you foreign nephews of dogs. This means war. See? Perfect excuse.
Do you need an excuse to have a war? Said Nobby.
I mean, who for? Can't you just say, you got lots of cash and land, but I've got a big sword, so divvy up right now, chop chop? That's what I'd do, said Corporal Nobbs, military strategist. And I wouldn't even say that until after I'd attacked.
Ah, but that's because you don't know about politics, said Colon.
You can't do that stuff anymore. Mark my words, this case has got politics written all over it. That's why old Vimes put me on it, depend upon it. Politics. Young Carrot's all very well, but you need a experienced man of the world in these delicate political situations.
You've certainly got the nose tapping just right, said Nobby. I generally miss.
But he felt troubled, if not in his nose, then in whatever small organ propelled his blood around his body. This didn't feel right. Nothing much in Nobby's life had ever felt right, so he knew very well how the feeling felt. He looked up at the bare walls and down at the rough floorboards.
There's a bit of sand on the floor, he said.
Another clue, then, said Colon happily. A Clatchian has been here. Bugger all else but sand in Clatch. Still got some in his sandals.
Nobby opened the window. It gave on to a gently sloping roof. Someone could get through it easily and be away over the tiles and into the maze of chimneys.
He could have gone in and out this way, Sarge, he volunteered.
Good point, Nobby. Write that down. Evidence of conniving and sneaking around.
Nobby peered down.
Here, there's glass outside, Fred.
Sergeant Colon joined him at the stricken window. One of the panes had been smashed. Outside, glass glittered on the tiles.
That could be a clue, eh?
Said Nobby, hopefully.
It certainly is, said Sergeant Colon. See, the glass fell outside the window. Everyone knows you look at which way the glass falls. I reckon he was just testing his bow, and it went off while he was loaded.
That's clever, Sarge, said Nobby.
That's detectorin, said Colon. It's no good just looking at things, Nobby. You gotta think straight, too.
Cecil, Sarge?
That's Frederick, Cecil. Come on, I think we've wrapped this up nicely. Old Vimes says he wants a report toot sweet.
Nobby looked out of the broken window. The roof abutted the end wall of a much larger warehouse. For a moment he found himself thinking bendy rather than straight, but he reasoned that his thinking was only a corporal's thinking and worth far less per thought than a sergeant's thinking, so he kept his private thoughts to himself. As they went downstairs, Mrs. Spent watched them suspiciously through a barely opened doorway at the far end of the hall, clearly ready to slam it shut at the first suggestion of any sexual magnetism.
It's not as if I even know where to get a sexual magnet, Nobby muttered. And she didn't even laugh.
Also, we went to the bow shops in the Street of Cunning Artificers and showed the iconograph to the man in Burly and Strong in the Arm who vouchsafed that is him, e.g. he was referring to the diseased. Oh, my. Vimes' lips moved slightly as his gaze went back up the page. Also, in addition to the Clatchian money, you could tell one of them had been there because of, e.g., the sand on the floor.
He'd still got sand in his sandals, murmured Vimes. Good grief.
Sam? Vimes looked up from his reading.
Your soup will be cold, said Lady Sybil from the far end of the table. You've been holding that spoonful in the air for the last 5 minutes by the clock.
Sorry, dear.
What are you reading?
Oh, just a little masterpiece, said Vimes, pushing Fred Colon's report aside.
Interesting, is it?
Said Lady Sybil a little sourly.
Practically unparalleled, said Vimes. The only things they haven't found are the bunch of dates and the camel hidden under the pillow.
Belatedly, his nuptial radar detected a certain chilliness from the far side of the cruet.
Is there something wrong, dear? He said.
Can you remember when we last had dinner together, Sam?
Tuesday, wasn't it?
That was the Guild of Merchants' annual dinner, Sam.
Vimes's brow wrinkled. But, You were there too, weren't you?
A further subtle change in the Dragon House quotient told him that this was not a well-chosen answer.
And then you rushed off afterwards because of that business with the barber in Gleam Street.
Sweeney Jones, said Vimes. Well, he was killing people, Sybil. The best you could say is that he didn't mean to. He was just very bad at shaving.
But you didn't have to go, I'm sure.
Policing's a 24-hour job, dear.
Only for you. Your constables do their 10 hours and that's it. But you're always working. It's not good for you. You're always running around during the day, and when I wake up in the middle of the night, there's always a cold space beside me.
The dots hung in the air, the ghosts of words unsaid. Little things, thought Vimes. That's how a war starts.
There's so much to do, Sybil, he said as patiently as he could. There's always been a lot to do, and the bigger the watch gets, the more there is to do. Have you noticed that?
Vimes nodded. That was true. Rotas, receipts, notebooks, reports. The watch might or might not be making a difference in the city, but it was certainly frightening a lot of trees.
You ought to delegate, said Lady Sybil.
So he tells me, muttered Vimes.
Pardon?
Just thinking aloud, dear. Vimes pushed the paperwork away. I'll tell you what. Let's have an evening in, he said. There's a nice fire in the drawing room.
No, Sam, there isn't.
Hasn't young Forthright lit it?
Forthright was the boy. It came as news to Vimes that this was an official servant position, but the boy's job was to light the fires, clean the privies, help the gardener, and take the blame.
He's gone off to be a drummer boy in the Duke of Eyall's regiment, said Lady Sybil.
Him too. He seemed a bright lad.
Isn't he too young? He said he was going to lie about his age.
I hope he lies about his musical ability. I've heard him whistling.
Vimes shook his head.
Whatever possessed him to do such a daft thing?
He thinks the uniform will impress the girls.
Sybil gave him a gentle smile. An evening at home suddenly began to seem very inviting.
Well, it won't take a genius to find the woodshed, said Vimes, and then we can bolt the doors and...
One of the aforesaid doors shook to the sound of frantic knocking. Vimes caught Sybil's gaze.
"Go on, then, answer it," she sighed and sat down.
The door admitted Corporal Littlebottom, seriously out of breath.
"You got to come quick, sir. It's murder this time."
Vimes looked helplessly at his wife.
"Of course you must go," she said.
Angua brushed out her hair in front of the mirror.
"I don't like this," said Carrot. "It's not a proper way to behave."
She patted him on the shoulder.
"Don't worry," she said. "Vimes explained it all. You're acting as though we're doing something wrong."
"I like being a watchman," said Carrot, still in the mournful depths.
"And you've got to wear a uniform. If you don't wear a uniform, it's like spying on people. He knows I think that."
Angua looked at his short red hair and honest ears.
"I've taken a lot of the work off his shoulders," Carrot went on. "He doesn't have to go on patrol at all, but he still tries to do everything."
"Perhaps he doesn't want you to be quite so helpful," said Angua, as tactfully as possible.
"It's not as if he's getting any younger either. I've tried to point that out."
"That was kind of you.
And I've never worn plain clothes."
"On you, they'll never be very plain," said Angua, pulling on her coat. It was a relief to be out of that armour. As for Carrot, there was no disguising him. The size, the ears, the red hair, the expression of muscular good-naturedness.
"I suppose a werewolf is in plain clothes all the time when you think about it," said Carrot.
"Thank you, Carrot,
and you're absolutely right. I just don't feel comfortable living a lie."
"Walk a mile on these paws."
"Pardon?"
"Oh, nothing." Gorif's son, Janil, had been angry. He didn't know why. The anger was built up of a lot of things. The firebomb last night was a big part. So were some of the words he'd been hearing in the street. He'd had an argument with his father about sending that food round to the watch house this morning. They were an official part of the city. They had those stupid badges. They had uniforms. He was angry about a lot of things, including the fact that he was 13. So when at 9 in the evening, while his father was baking bread, the door had slammed back and a man had rushed in, Janil had pulled his father's elderly crossbow from under the counter and aimed it where he thought the heart was, and pulled the trigger. Carrot stamped his feet once or twice and looked around. "Here," he said. "I was standing here, and the prince was in that direction." Angua obediently walked across the square. Several people turned to look curiously at Carrot. "All right,"